Welcome. Girl Up Aurum, a campaign of the United Nations Foundation, is honored to welcome you on The Voice of Aurum, a podcast aimed to amplify the voices of some incredible women coming from all walks of life. We at Girl Up Aurum believe that every career path, whether an artist, a musician, or a scientist, will have its mountains to climb. So let's get on this journey with your host Anushka Makhloka and get an inside scoop on how these women climbed their mountains to success. Today I have with me Pragya Khanna. She's a Mumbai-based lawyer as well as the co-founder of this beautiful venture called Roha, which is working towards gender equity and sustainable development. She's conducted various workshops across India with underprivileged children and slum dwellers in schools and workplaces to sensitize people about sexual abuse and violence. She believes in the power of collaboration. So without any further ado, let's dive into this interesting and important conversation. So a very warm welcome, Pragya. Thank you for taking out the time and being here. And let's dive into the questions and tell us about your childhood, your schooling, and your college years. How has that year and how has the period shaped you as the person you are today?
So I think for every individual, your initial years of experience, and your interactions with family and the people around you, subconsciously, you know, has a very deep impact in the choices that we go on to make later in life. And I feel like for some people, you know, you may not be able to connect the dots. And for some people, it might be pretty apparent. For me, although I did not ever plan becoming a lawyer or a social entrepreneur or, you know, even doing what I'm doing today. But when I look back, you know, I can somewhat connect the dots because my mother was a single parent. And I've never met my biological father. And my parents were separated and then, you know, divorced very early, maybe a couple of years into their marriage. And I was probably like maybe two or three or something. And I've grown up with my mom and my maternal grandparents here in Bombay. And my mom was also very, very young when she had me. She was just 18 and I was born to her. So I've had a very unconventional upbringing in that sense because for me, it was, you know, my mom was very young. She was my friend. She was also somebody that I've always looked up to. And of course, a great parent in that sense. So I think that has had a deep impact on the person that I am today. I think maybe on my understanding of people and the kind of relationships that I went on to forge in my life, which were perhaps a little different from, I have some great memories and I also have some, I do recall some people being very nasty and mean, in school because you're not very aware about somebody else's circumstances or, you know, how they're feeling. Mm-hmm. And perhaps you're not sensitized enough to understand that. And I think consequently, it kind of leads to I don't want to call it bullying and ragging, but, you know, to a point where you end up sort of hurting the other person, you know, your peer or your schoolmate and your friend. Right. And, moving on, I feel that it started to change, with every difficult and challenging experience that life threw at me, whether it was in school, college, or at home. I started to change a lot as a person. I think I became wiser, for one, and I think much more fierce in being independent and, you know, a lot more confident about myself. So people have judged me, without sort of knowing the truth. And I think that's a common sort of streak that I see now in the work that I do, especially with gender issues and, trying to sort of build empathy from scratch in people. But I think overall, I would definitely say that my initial years, at least the first I think even till up until now, but definitely the first 2 decades of my life have had a very strong impact on my work now.
Right. And as you mentioned that you started studying law, so talking about gender advocacy or becoming a gender advocate, so was it something that you always wanted to become, or it eventually happened?
I became a gender advocate by chance. But I also think that it was, you know, from what I just shared, I also think that it was sort of meant to be for me. Because I have grown up in an environment where I saw gender inequality very closely. And I also saw, you know, my mom, who was obviously the more marginalized gender, really, really stand up for herself in a time where it's tough to be a single parent. It's tough to not have education and, you know, sort of make a life for yourself and for your child. Mm-hmm. And I think as a person, I've always been a lot more aware and sensitive to what's happening around me. In school, college, I would, you know, in my free time, I've interned or rather volunteered with a lot of NGOs. I've worked with autistic kids. I've worked with, blind children, different NGOs for different reasons. And when I completed my law degree in 2015 from Bombay University, and after that, like I really wasn't planning to, you know, sort of kickstart my career as a lawyer. I wanted to sort of take a break and figure it out. And in that figuring out period, an opportunity came my way with this organization called She Says India that was working in educating and rehabilitating women and girls. Mm-hmm. And they needed a lawyer. And because I did have some personal experiences also, and also, you know, maybe an incline towards understanding laws which were more humanitarian, and related to people and the environment, I sort of jumped on that opportunity that I got. And I worked with them for 3 years as a gender advocacy director. So my role pretty much started as somebody who would curate and conduct gender sensitization workshops for children. And then I went on to conducting it for, say, teenagers, adolescents, and then workplaces. So that kind of gave me a strong foothold in grassroots and policy, you know, level experience in gender issues in India. So that kickstarted my official, career or path in gender advocacy. And then after that, I mean, it's just, it just kept happening organically that I stuck to what I'm doing. And it's been a few years now. So I've, you know, moved into also understanding issues of domestic violence and abuse and child marriage, things I weren't doing earlier. And also looking at sexual harassment, you know, from a gender inclusive lens. So that's how I chanced upon this, work that I'm doing today.
Great. And talking about Roha, you co-founded Roha. It's a beautiful yet an important venture, which literally translates into generating cause. So how did you get started with it? And tell us more about it.
So Roha, actually, again, like everything else in my life, was very organic. It just came to me. And so I'm like my husband now, and back then in 2018, we were, we were friends, we were together, but we went to this place called Ghum. It's a small town, which is a few kilometers from Darjeeling in West Bengal. And he had been going there for a couple of years to do cleanup drives with a school called the Ghum Girls High School. So that school there is, he was doing cleanup drives with them because he's also very passionate about upcycling and recycling and, you know, teaching young children about segregation of waste. And so it's a small town, and, you know, if the entire school sort of gets together, it's easy to clean, all the streets. And in 2018, he sort of asked me if I wanted to accompany him. And I said yes, and I went, and I thought that, you know, these girls have never had any sensitization sessions or workshops as such. And if I'm there, I might as well, you know, do something productive. Right. So I ended up taking a lot of workshops on, gender issues. So we talked about child marriage. We talked about domestic abuse, child sexual abuse, sexual harassment. And the population is largely Nepali. but there are also some people from UP, there are some people from, there are also some Tibetan people over there. Okay. And we, after conducting, I think, sessions with class 5 to probably class 11 or 12, what happened was that around 15, 20 girls who must have reflected and realized that certain incidents that happened in their life, which, you know, were obviously inappropriate, and, you know, due to not knowing what those experiences or those instances were, they did not bring it up, or perhaps because these conversations rarely happen at home, went to the headmistress and opened up about these instances. So from there, the headmistress sort of said that, okay, these girls want to speak to you. And when I individually spoke to each of them, it was very, very overwhelming, because there were lots of issues like child marriage, stalking, eve teasing. And these are young girls, you know, from 9, 10 years to like 14, 15 years of age.
Okay.
And they obviously, you know, found that space safe enough to talk about these issues. And, you know, we had time so we could resolve three, which were two cases of child marriage and one was of child sexual abuse. And that whole journey was very on ground, in the sense that even for me, it was the first time, you know, teaming up with the police, going to look for the person who was basically the sexual predator, who was not only had a single girl who spoke up, but a lot of other children in the neighborhood. And one thing led to another. And, you know, when we came back, we just thought that it has made a difference, because what I saw in Groom was different stakeholders coming together and taking part, like the police, there was a local NGO, there was the headmistress and the teachers from the school, and of course the girls who were affected by the violence and abuse, who showed the courage to speak up, you know, just after a couple of workshops. So we found merit in doing this at a larger scale. And my expertise and passion is more in gender issues, and, you know, my husband's was more in sustainability, more from a consumption point of view. So we decided to, you know, marry the two problems. And today, you know, we end up working in the intersectional space also, because gender and sustainability, gender and climate have a very close and intimate relationship. So that's how we thought that, you know, we want to start an organization that is grassroots at its heart and, you know, does both of these issues. So that's how OHA started for us.
That's really great. So as you mentioned, the incident in Ghum, and similarly, being a woman who's taking such bold steps regularly to promote and achieve gender equality is at times not taken positively. And whether it's urban or rural, people usually don't like others meddling in their own affairs, even if they know that they're wrong. So I'm sure these are the very few challenges that arise. What are some other challenges that you face?
There are tons of problems. I don't know where to start, honestly. So see, the thing with, you know, the space of gender equality or gender sensitization, the biggest issue is that people are very good at covering up. So, especially in an urban sort of an environment. And what I mean by this is, you know, you may be in, like, you may inherently be patriarchal, or you may be, you know, slightly regressive in your thought process. But in an urban environment, you sort of are, I mean, you put up, right? Because you live in a metro and a cosmo place. So you have to portray some sense of, you know, like just some benchmark of being empathetic or being decent at, you know, home or workplace or whatever. And I think the biggest challenge with this is because we are trying to break stereotypes, we are trying to change people's mindsets and behavior, right, which has been set in stone for so many years when it comes to looking at different genders. It's very difficult because, number one, I think that oppression and patriarchy are still very prevalent in our thoughts, in our cultural practices, in the way we sort of conduct ourselves. And even in the most, you know, progressive of, with the most progressive mindsets or in situations that would call for equality in its true sense, I think it still can't be achieved. Because there are lots of places where women do step down or have to take a back seat or rather have a very unique set of challenges, which I think is not acknowledged or regarded enough, you know, by people at home or by workplaces.
Right.
And I think the second problem is that a lot of organizations take it slightly lightly. Like they think it's more of a compliance, you know, from a compliance point of view to say have a workshop or a sensitization program. But the importance of this can't be emphasized enough, you know, especially in educational institutions and workplaces, because it's a lot more than just knowing your rights. It's a lot more than just understanding the law. It's really going back to understanding human behavior and understanding empathy, which we all are capable of, but I think somewhere we just forget it because it's more convenient to move with the stride, right? Which is and moving with the stride is typically not acting in an entirely gender inclusive or equal manner. So there are problems because you know, these barriers are, they make it real. I think the third problem with the work that we do is we don't get paid enough. And this is a huge problem, you know, because people think that, okay, you're in the social sector. This is supposed to be done pro bono. But that's not, I think that's a very wrong perspective to have, because like any other job or any other, you know, service that you offer, which has a commercial objective, this may have a humanitarian objective at the end of it, and we will keep going no matter what. But I feel like funding and, you know, the fact that organizations like ours, people, you know, would like to sort of cut short with payments or, you know, bargain a lot with us, negotiate a lot with us when we quote for workshops and insist on having free sessions. I think these are like some, you know, relevant barriers that I'd like to highlight, because it's difficult for us also, you know, to do this. It's very convenient for somebody to just say, okay, a third person or an organization has taken up the responsibility for this. But what we're trying to do actually is bring about, you know, tangible impact in our immediate environments. So I think that, yeah, that it's really hard. And I've had some, you know, difficult experiences in workshops where I have had to, you know, sort of have conversations with minds that are extremely, you know, patriarchal. They're extremely oppressive. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are in complete denial of the fact that gender issues are even a reality. Because to them, you know, in a lot of cultures, this is equality. The fact that women are not equal to men is the norm. So there's nothing wrong with it, right? And when you try to disturb that status quo by, you know, breaking the bubble and saying that, hey, look, what you're thinking is totally incorrect. Women and men are absolutely on equal footing. It doesn't go down well very easily. So I think baby steps for us, yes, but yeah, definitely it's a tough journey.
Right. I think there's a long way to go. And talking about breaking the bubble, are there any differences between urban and rural in regards to gender sensitization issues? Because like we were previously talking about, I think there are a lot of similarities, but can you elaborate on them and can you tell us about the differences?
I think similarities are the fact that gender issues are prevalent in the urban and the rural environment. I mean, you can't say that in a more privileged or a more literate environment, people are acting in exactly, you know, the manner that is right and required. That's not true. And the kind of instances that you see of sexual abuse and violence also overlap to a large extent. But obviously, there are some glaring differences, I think, starting from the fact that the kind of inequality is very different. Like, for instance, take, for example, you and me, okay? Both of us coming from a certain socioeconomic strata in an urban environment, having similar sets of privileges growing up, access to certain kind of information, compared to, say, a boy of a similar age in the rural area. So you get what I'm saying? He would have not had the similar opportunities or experiences that you and I would have. So in this situation, the boy who's you know, obviously not considered to be the oppressed gender, but between us and him, he is the more unequal person. So I think that what happens is that when we look at these issues, we have to see that what kind of inequality are we dealing with. And it's not entirely a gender issue in the sense that all girls and all women are oppressed in the rural area. And, you know, all women and all girls are empowered and liberated in an urban environment. So some of the other barriers that we see are obviously in an urban environment. You can do most of your work in English and some of your work in Hindi. But in the rural environment, you really need the expertise of regional language. And there are so many different kinds of dialects and languages that are spoken. So that's a huge barrier in getting down to the grassroots in the rural areas to do the work, because you need a lot of resources and a lot of skilled people without compromising the quality of your work to talk to them in their language, you know, something that they resonate with rather than coming and speaking in English, Hindi and having somebody translate the work for you. Right. And of course, then there are like lots of cultural and religious barriers, because I think the rural setup is still very particular about following certain traditional cultural belief systems, which, you know, do become, I think, greater barriers in, you know, sort of at least peeling off the first layer and getting down to the root of understanding where the gender inequality or oppression is stemming from. And I think the most obvious difference that there is poverty. You know, when you are struggling with sexual abuse or violence or any kind of gender-based inequality in an environment that is suffering from poverty, or, you know, is at the lowest rung of the economic strata of society, the kind of issues that you have are very different. You know, things like not having access to basic nutrition is a big problem. You know, for a lot of girls that I work with and interact with, like the fact that they are interested in pursuing their education is a big problem. There is a pressure of being compelled into marriage at a very young age. So, you know, it's not really about choosing one stream over another or having issues at workplace, which is more common in the urban environment, right? Like facing some sort of discrimination at the workplace, or say having a lesser quota or representation for the women population as opposed to male counterparts, or having more men on the top, right? Like the senior management or board of directors. So if you compare the two environments, when you break down the issues of sexual abuse and violence, maybe, you know, similar, but the reasons that are leading to it and also the resources available to deal with those problems are very different.
Right. And talking about sexual harassment, not only women are harassed sexually, but there's also a percentage of men who suffer from sexual abuse too. However, rarely any man files a report against the abuse. So why is that? And do the Indian laws support men going through such abuses?
So I think the fact that men and boys don't report sexual abuse and violence is also a gender stereotype, right? Because say in the Indian context, men have always been apparently at least shouldered with the responsibility of, you know, winning the bread, running the house, taking important decisions, dealing with money. And they have, and then of course you have the great effort of, you know, the Indian, the Hindi cinema and pop culture and generally social media now, you know, which is causing to portray genders in a very, very, you know, typical and, you know, bracketed sort of a manner. And then there are categories, right, of boys and men. And I feel like there is equal amount of pressure from society on boys and men to constantly not break down, you know, to constantly be strong and be invincible almost. So I feel like, you know, we really think that all, you know, the men, like in Indian men, they're all like superheroes and nothing can go wrong with them. And I think that's where we take a we take so many steps behind in this fight against gender inequality and sexual abuse and violence, because while we may be making significant progress in, you know, dealing with the problem of abuse and violence against women and girls, we're not able to touch working with boys and men because they don't want to speak up about it.
Exactly.
And honestly, it takes women also great amount of courage and, you know, reflection and convincing and, you know, generally ability to come forward and talk about this. For boys and men, it is that much more harder because then, you know, the focus is more on the fact that he's probably not straight, or, you know, making fun of that person, questioning the person's sexuality, you know, thinking that this boy or this man is weak, you know, who can allow something like this to happen to him. So there are very deep-rooted, you know, thought processes that people have. And of course, denial, you know, like how many families and how many parents would acknowledge the fact that their boys and men have been sexually abused or violated at some point, either in their childhood or in their adult life. And another problem is that all the laws that we have today in India, which address sexual abuse and violence, are, except for the laws that deal with child sexual abuse, they don't acknowledge, or rather they don't recognize men to be victims of sexual assault and violence. And the reason is that, you know, if you see statistically, the reports and the complaints that are filed are all women.
Okay.
And, you know, now perhaps queer people also, you know, coming up and speaking about the violence and abuse that they have been suffering. But when it comes to, you know, the law sort of changing, I think it's a two-way process. It we cannot come, you know, to a situation where, say, the law amends and, you know, introduces equal amount of protection and ability for men to report sexual abuse and violence against them, while we are like miles behind in achieving or even starting those conversations at home or in schools and, you know, in our societies. So I think the effort has to be from both ends. Honestly, in my in the few years that I have worked in this field, I have only spoken to two men who have come out and, you know, openly acknowledged that the fact that they have been sexually abused and harassed. And I still remember this one time that I was taking a workshop with one company. I don't want to take any names, but there were about, I think there were about 100 people in that session. And there was a man who came out, took the mic from me and, you know, in front of all the other colleagues, spoke about the fact that he was sexually harassed as a child. And he almost, you know, he was very emotional. And I think that is the right kind of attitude that we need to have. We have to de-link gender from sexual abuse and violence and independently recognize sexual assault as a gross violation of, you know, the human body and rights, and not constantly associated with women and girls, which I think will discourage a lot of boys who are silently suffering to come out and speak about it.
Right. I think, again, a very long way to go with this and a lot of stigma and taboo surrounding it, which needs to be broken. Moving on and talking about Me Too, the initial purpose was to empower the females to stand out bravely and heal themselves. It was a voluntary move and its aim was to encourage people against sexual harassment or assault and defend themselves. And not just celebrities or known people, but people, young women, young females came out and spoke about any form of abuse that they were facing at their workplace or at home. So how do you see the progression of these movements for more women empowerment in India?
Well, I think for one, these movements, as you rightly pointed out, do inspire confidence in others. You know, when they look up to, when they see people around openly sharing their stories and their experiences, I think it does give you a little bit of encouragement. You know, to come out and either talk about it to somebody in person or, you know, talk about it on social media. And I think as a result of Me Too movement, that has definitely increased. People may not want to take any action per se, but calling out bad behavior has definitely gone up. And I think that that is necessary. One of the ways in addressing the problem of, you know, sexual harassment and sexual abuse is that you need to constantly call, you know, these perpetrators out and make it known to them that, you know, it's the fact that they have committed a crime or they have sexually offended somebody is not hidden under the carpet. So that's like, you know, that's the first step. But I think the problem with movements like Me Too is that they don't translate into, say, enough. I think they don't translate into redressal a lot. And what I mean by this is that while people have taken one step forward in the right direction and are, you know, perhaps talking about it, I feel like not enough is done to back it up so that you can continue it in a sustainable manner. Like a Me Too should not reduce itself to a hashtag on Twitter or, you know, LinkedIn or Facebook. It should translate itself into sensitive workplaces, you know, into action, that palpable action, you know, taken against men and other sexual predators at the workplace, because there are lots of stakeholders that are involved, you know, when there is sexual harassment at the workplace. You have the woman or the person who's complaining, then you have the person who's offended, you have the organization, you have the management, you have the media, you have the government. There are lots of stakeholders. And I feel like each stakeholder and the relevant persons from each stakeholder need to be adequately sensitized so that you can do something about this. Like, you know, when you don't want to take action against somebody, but you come out on Twitter and you just tag somebody and you post about it. And tomorrow, everybody knows, okay, everybody who's read that tweet is aware that X person has been, you know, has a history of sexually harassing. But it's a question mark because you don't want to take any action, which is absolutely okay and it's your right. But I think somewhere the consequence of that is that there is no investigation and no inquiry because, you know, the process under law has not started and has not kicked in. So you don't know if nobody else sort of comes up and speaks and tags the same person, then I think that person has to live with that stigma until something is really done about it. And I feel similarly with women also that has happened. As a result of Me Too, you know, in all fairness, I feel like a lot of men who were accused of sexually harassing women have sort of lashed out at them by filing defamation suits against them. And you still find these men very much present, right? Whether it's the film industry or whether it's the music industry or whether it's at the workplace, they may not be working in A organization, but they've probably moved to B organization or started on their own. So they're still very much a part of our workforce without having gone through enough of, you know, sensitization and I think change in behavior. So the chances of the incident repeating itself is not completely undone. So I think that, you know, while these movements are great and we have to encourage more and more such movements, I feel like it should be a little more inclusive because if you don't have access to social media, you're not a part of Me Too movement, right? Again, coming back to the difference in the urban and rural. So a huge population that suffers sexual harassment is totally cut off from this movement. And then it has to be gender inclusive also. So I feel we have reached a stage, you know, where we can talk about these issues in a gender inclusive manner. So I think that there are, like, a lot needs to be done to make them, I think, more efficient in achieving the end goal.
Right. And something also seen in these movements is the increase of false allegations, because it's so easy now to go online and tag someone and tell them that you did this and portray as a victim. So what is your take on this? Is it diverting the attention from questions that are ultimately more instructive for preventing sexual violence?
So see, I mean, there's no denying of the fact that social media is a very powerful tool today. Mm. And within seconds, you know, you can reach millions of people who have access to that information. And that's what, you know, when you make a statement that is incorrect or false, it will have a negative consequence on maybe somebody who didn't do the act that you are, you know, holding them against. But at the same time, like, you know, you can't stop working towards the cause, or you can't like stop making the efforts of, you know, acknowledging the fact that many, many women who spoke up in the Me Too movement, a large percentage of them were sharing the truth. And, you know, a percentage of those women wanted some remedy, some recourse. You know, okay. they wanted the justice system to get activated and, you know, for their perpetrators to be put to justice for whatever they did. So I think that any crime that you take today, or any issue that you pick up today, not everybody is 100% honest about what they're saying. And I mean, I'm a lawyer and I can say this safely, that, you know, even in the experiences that I've had with a lot of people, much later, you know, I have realized, or I have come to know, that the girl or the woman who reached out to us for help was the one who was actually lying, or, you know, had did not speak the entire truth. And then there are lots of people who tell you that they want to fight it out, but they you know, sort of commit themselves to it, and then they withdraw and don't fight the fight. So I think that doesn't deter us from continuing, because number one rule of dealing with gender and sexual violence related problems is that disbelieving the person is not your job. Your job is to believe the person who's come to you, and to honestly, without favoring one or the other. And specifically, I can say this because I work with organizations on sexual harassment in the workplace, and I conduct trainings, and I also sit on the committees that conduct these inquiries. And having interacted with people who have complained about sexual harassment, and those who have been accused of it, and even the other, you know, sort of colleagues who were involved in the matter at the workplace, I think you just have to do more of a fact-finding process and get to the root of it, and make the best assessment you can with whatever information you have gathered. And I think with experience, you will be able to tell eventually what are the false allegations and whether something like that truly happened. And for people who make false allegations, also the law has, you know, provided for the same consequences that would be applicable to somebody who would, you know, be accused of sexually harassing someone. So I think that it's again, what I feel the solution is, that when you have a good holistic gender sensitization workshop, or, you know, enough of these programs with the relevant stakeholders in an organization, you are not only sensitizing the men, you know, towards not, you know, engaging in conduct and practices that can sexually offend their female colleagues and counterparts, but you are also sensitizing the women who have a very powerful tool, you know, through the law and, you know, through the processes set out in the workplace, that you should you should utilize it when there is a genuine issue and concern, rather than misusing it as a tool to sort of, you know, settle scores with somebody. So this is really, I think, it depends from person to person. I don't think this is so much of a gender issue as it is, you know, how you are as a person and what you want to do with the resources that are made available to you.
Right. And as we come to the end of our podcast, if any one of our listeners are going through any kind of abuse, what is it that you recommend, and what is that you advise them to do? How should they go about it?
So I think that you can't give advice to anyone who's gone through any form of sexual abuse or violence. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say this is because each person's, you know, experience and journey going through that incident, that unfortunate incident, and also dealing with it is very different. And I have interacted with people of different genders, different age groups, right from age 4 or 5 years old, all the way up to, you know, elderly people in their 60s, who've 60s, 70s, who've been through sexual harassment and abuse at some point in their life. And they all have a very different approach to it. So, but what I feel is a common factor, or is something that is applicable to everybody, would be that keeping quiet about it does not serve any purpose. Because when you keep quiet about it, and when you suffer in silence, not using, say, help that can be made available to you or resources, or making an effort to, you know, sort of bring the truth to the table, you end up suffering the most. Because sexual abuse and violence, more than anything else, and more than the physical act, you know, and there are lots of statistics and studies around this, have deep and irreversible ramifications on a person's mental state and emotional well-being.
Right.
So it's something that will go on to affect your relationships with other people. It can, you know, create some sort of fear and anxiousness, trust issues, withdrawal, you know, from people and society, and lead to other mental health problems. And maybe this is not 100% true in every person's case, but largely from what I have seen and people I've worked with, I have noticed that this is definitely a common impact. So I think my only request would be that, you know, as everyone says, that you must understand the fact that maybe right now in your immediate environment, there is nobody you can approach who you feel safe enough to talk about this with, but you're not alone. So if you have the resources to look up for a safe individual or organization that you can share this with, and I'm absolutely not saying that every person who goes through it needs to come out on social media or needs to go and file an FIR and, you know, put the person to trial. Absolutely not. But talking about it and dealing with it also includes, you know, maybe sharing it with a mental health supporter or a professional or just a friend that you trust, you know, that's a problem today, because most people either disbelieve it or disregard it. And, you know, there are very common nonchalant responses that come from, especially, you know, people at home, that it's not a big deal. You know, we've all gone through it. We live in India. Exactly. This is happening. This is the culture. And I think that the advice is more for others who are surrounding this person who's gone through sexual abuse and violence, that please stop belittling and demeaning that person's story because you chose to deal with it in a different way. So I think we need to direct and support people to look within and realize for each person, how is it that I want to deal with this situation, but help them acknowledge it, because suppressing these incidents will really have, you know, worse impacts. And I think second is, you know, if you can fight the fight, there are legal options available. There are tons of, you know, laws and processes set in place. I know that the Indian judicial system is very slow. And, you know, a lot of people say that it's very corrupted. And there is no denying about this. But there's also no denying of the fact that there have been lots of landmark cases in, you know, from the same courts and the same country where we have actually benefited, you know, from putting, you know, certain accused people of very severe crimes to trial. So I think that you can, as somebody who's suffering, I mean, what I can offer you right now is, you know, Roha is very active in this space. We do provide redressal support. So if anyone listening wants to, you know, take action or wants to simply share or needs a mental health supporter, you know, I, for one, I'm a trained mental health supporter now. And, you know, I've also been through sexual abuse and violence and, you know, sexual harassment in my life. And I mean, I don't talk, you know, very openly about it. The reason is because people feel that that is the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing. But, you know, it's not true. It's not true that every person, because every person at some point in their life has gone through this. And not every person has, you know, entered the space of working in gender and sexual violence. So to everybody listening, regardless of your gender, please reach out to Roha, you know, or me, and any one of us in Roha through our website or Instagram page. And we would do the best that we can to support you, you know, deal with whatever it is that you're going through. But there is no merit in just suffering with the trauma and, you know, allowing, creating more and more space for the predator or the perpetrator to constantly take advantage of you.
Right, I think Roha is a great platform and I think everyone should go check it out. I'll definitely link them down below. Moving on, one last question is that what is the vision of you and Roha in the coming years? Like, where do you see the organization heading and how much impact do you want to have?
This is such a difficult question for me to answer because my entire life has just, you know, like I was sharing, it's been one thing led to another. So I've never, like there have been very few occasions in my life where I've actually sat down and planned things to the T. I mean, far, far ahead, obviously. Otherwise, I mean, I do plan a lot. But, you know, like Roha just sort of happened and the work that I'm doing. But I think, you know, if I have to at all, like, you know, think about something, I would say that from the more tangible and practical, you know, factors, number one priority is to do the work that we're doing in regional languages, because I really believe that more work needs to be done in rural areas, especially when it comes to issues like gender sensitization and sexual harassment, because there are a lot of people doing great work in, you know, urban and semi-urban environments, but I feel like the rural population is left behind, you know, from this conversation. Second, I think would be to sort of develop a, you know, responsible and dependable team. And we do have a gender inclusive team at Roha, which I'm very proud of. And I want to maintain that, you know, going forward. I want people of, you know, from all walks of life, regardless of their sexuality, their gender, caste, whatever it is, you know, that are barriers in today's day and age to do work or, you know, to sort of be part of organizations at a larger scale, should come and, you know, come forward and be part of Roha. And I think my third, like more tangible vision is funding, because that is something, since we're a new and young organization, we don't have that much resources and expertise to really go out there and, you know, be aggressive with fundraising. So that's something that, you know, I really hope that in the coming time, we're able to resolve and address. And I think the more overarching vision, which I've always had, is that, you know, my heart is in the right place. And it really doesn't matter to me that, you know, where I'm going on social media or otherwise, you know, in the more conventional sense. But for me, the true impact and assessment is surely made with all the gender inclusive initiatives we take at the grassroots level. When we interact with each person, you know, through our workshops and through our collaborations and, you know, involving all the stakeholders, I feel like every life transformed and every mindset changed for their betterment, you know, and their well-being. That is something that, you know, keeps me going. And I want those numbers to be like skyrocketing, you know, that so many people, you know, were able to benefit from the work that we want to do.
And that was Pragya Khanna. The entire conversation gave me goosebumps. So go check out Roha and reach out to them at roha.org. You can also contact Pragya on Instagram at Pragya Khanna. You can follow Girl Up at girlup.orum on Instagram. So thank you for listening. Until next time. Bye-bye.